Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Going to try to connect with Kim Witzik, and for those of you who know her already, she is the FDA committee's person supposedly representing the public, and she's on now. Kim, are you there?
I am. Good afternoon, Peter.
Oh, hi, Kim. Well, it's really an odd day today. I don't know that I've even spoken to anybody on the air yet. I don't know what's gotten through. So I wanted to start out again and say, hi, folks. Sorry about this being a mess. And Kim, instead of my even trying to introduce you, I'm going to take a breath and say, Kim Witzik, take over. Tell folks about yourself and all the amazing things you're involved in. And I'm going to take a deep breath and gather my wits. Thanks for listening, folks. You're going to learn a lot about the FDA in the next few minutes.
Great. Well, thanks. First of all, thanks, Peter, and thanks to your audience. As Peter mentioned, my name's Kim Witzak. I have been, as he said, I'm on the FDA Psychopharmacologic Drugs Advisory Committee as consumer representative, and my role is really representing the public and in conversations where drug applications or companies are coming forward to the FDA to get a drug. An FDA advisory committee, it's because there's some kind of issue that the FDA wants to get the opinions from the advisory committee, which usually is a bunch of, you know, academia, healthcare providers, you know, physicians, researchers, and consumer representatives, as well as who represents the disease at hand. So they're called the patient rep. Background, how I got onto this.
You're breaking up a little bit, Kim. Kim, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
You're breaking up. This is nothing to do with my end now.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, but you're breaking up. All right. Why don't you continue? We're talking about now you're on the psychopharmacology committee. God knows how you've stayed on this long, but can you continue?
Sure. Yes, and as I was mentioning, how I've been working on this work since the death of my husband back in 2003. So I've been participating as a member of the public, attending FDA advisory committee meetings way back in 2003. 2004, when they were looking at antidepressants and the link between suicide. And then subsequently over the years, has really been involved in most of the psychopharmacologic drugs, so the psych drugs. So now I did, you know, a couple of years ago, I was asked to be on the committee as a voting member. So now I have the opportunity to be on the other side of the table and actually be a part of the process. So, you know, I get to analyze the data that the companies are using and presenting to the FDA to get an approval. So it's a very unique perspective, you know, being on the other side of the table, because I've always been on, you know, from the watching public, I should say, you know, coming to attend these advisory committees. So, I've had a couple of really unique experiences, and the one that probably has caught a lot of attention most recently was my first advisory committee meeting as the consumer rep, and there was a recent CNN drug called Nuplazid, which is a drug that was used for Parkinson's psychosis. And their CNN just had a big an article about it and a big investigation, because as they were looking into FDA reports, adverse event reports, there's been over 700 deaths already reported into the FDA since this drug came on the market. And that was in, I think, April 2016. So what's interesting about this, and I remember at the time at the committee meeting, there's so many things I could talk about this drug in itself. But at the end of the day, what I thought was interesting, and then we can back into the actual drug and the different things that I learned, and, you know, kind of the things that I'm surprised that it wasn't ever brought up until now, you know, CNN looking at it. But there were the drug eventually did get FDA approval, or FDA advisory committee approval, 12-2. And there were two no votes.
Before we go any further, talk a little more about what this drug was for.
Okay.
And this is Nuplazid we're talking about?
Yes, Nuplazid.
Yeah. And what is this drug? What is it for? What is it? What's it similar to in the way of drugs? Basically to treat psychosis associated with Parkinsonism. Is that correct?
Yes, it was.
Most of the psychosis I've seen with Parkinsonism and studied and researched is caused by the psychiatric drugs, not by the Parkinsonism. Is that one of the issues here?
Yes. My background, I had to go learn about Parkinson's and the disease and what drugs they're using to treat Parkinson's, et cetera. And one of the things that I learned is really that a lot of the psychosis is actually being caused by the drugs that they're used to treat Parkinson's. So this was a new, and it's basically an antipsychotic. And this, you know, a little backstory on this company, Acadia. This was their third time that they went before the FDA, because the last two clinical trials that they tried getting this drug approved in the past failed. But they were able to use a new mechanism that Congress actually voted in play, which is called the Breakthrough Therapy Designation. So basically, it is saying that, you know, there's always the pressure of the FDA takes too long to approve drugs. You know, we need drugs on the market faster. And this was basically a mechanism that Congress put in play that would allow drugs to be given quicker review if it was for a serious life-threatening disease and there's nothing on the market to help with this, no other drug on the market. They can use this where they only need to have one clinical trial to get a drug approved, versus the gold standard of having to have two double-blind placebo-controlled studies. So that, I think, is really interesting in itself, that it had failed twice before when they had to have two clinical trials. Now, fast forward, they were able to use this new mechanism to get it approved, where they
and they can fail it. All those failed trials don't matter, folks. All they have to do is get what's required. Usually required two. You can fail 20 times, which makes no scientific sense, no rational sense at all. It only makes drug company money sense. And so now I'm learning with you about all this, folks. So now we have a drug that's going to be approved on the basis of one fake controlled clinical trial by a drug company, and we're basically approving an antipsychotic drug, a dopamine blocker. Is that what we're dealing with here? Must be.
I believe so.
Yeah, and I noticed the warning is the same for other dopamine blockers of the new kind, which is that. Don't give it to that it causes death in people with elderly with dementia And that's going to be an awful lot of the folks with Parkinsonism to start with are going to be elderly people with dementia. I mean, this was just a horror story waiting to happen.
Right.
But let you go on again as we're both getting settled into the show.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. So on this one, looking back, I just explained how when it tried before, it failed, the two. Now they're coming through with a new trial. 199 people total in this trial. And ultimately, only 89 people had the drug completed the six-week trial. So, and 87 placebo. So there's a drop-off. And just that in itself, to think about a disease that potentially has, you've got millions of people, but it's only been really approved on 89 people who actually took the drug. The other part of, the other half of the group was placebo. So it was that was one of the issues, is just the numbers, sheer number. And I remember one of my questions I even actually asked Dr. Temple, who's been at the FDA for a long time and involved in all the antidepressants and whatnot. I remember asking, do you think that is a good number? Like that doesn't seem like a high enough number to be in a clinical trial. And I remember his response was, well, it's probably not as much as we would like it to be. But, with these new breakthrough therapy, if it's a cancer drug, it might only have a few people in the trial. So I think that idea in itself was, should be something that should be concerning to both the public as well as, the physicians that will ultimately prescribe this. So that was one thing. Then the other was back when the previous trials had failed, they had used a measuring system, the SAPS, which is it's basically measuring like psychosis and hallucinations and whatnot. It was 20-point questions. Well, they somehow adapted it down to 9 questions. So now in order to, you had 20 and now it's down to 9. So that in itself, are you picking the best potentially that'll give you, the results that you want. So that was another thing that I was concerned with. And then to speak of just purely when you look at the results from the 199 people, for every 50% of people that had a reduction, for every 2 people that had 50% reduction in psychosis, a third person would have severe adverse event. So to me, that 50% reduction for every 2 people would be, just 50% reduction, a third person would have severe adverse event. To me, that wasn't a risk benefit ratio that I felt like that really under the guise of how it was getting approved and, being that my professional background is in advertising and marketing. So I could see it being completely, for the desperate people out there and the way it would be communicated via, the drug company PR, it would be seen as a breakthrough therapy drug. This is going to, all these Parkinson's patients, it's going to revolutionize them. And so that basically they don't have the whole backstory of this. So that's just a little bit there, but I have to say one of the biggest things that I was concerned with, Peter, is in addition to just reading all the, the materials, our briefing materials that came to us before the meeting, I actually did one thing further, which is I went and listened to the CEO Wall Street calls, his analyst calls with Wall Street. And I wanted to hear how he and how the Wall Street analysts were talking about this this drug, this company, because I wanted to understand who this company was. And one of the things from the beginning was this was basically a make or break FDA approval or for this drug for the company. It was kind of its last shot for this biotech company out of San Diego. So that in itself was light bulb went off. Okay, this is a make or break for the company. So that in itself, I'm sure all hands are on deck to we're getting this drug approved. So then when you listen to the CEO call and then you start reading, and I always believe, Peter, some of my favorite things to do, in addition to even just like when something's recorded, is to actually go in and listen and read the comments that people have to say, you know, because that really gives you the pulse of what people are thinking, right? But this was different because these are Wall Street analysts. And I remember reading one of them where it talked about that this had the, it was one of the Wall Street analysts that said this had the potential of being a $5 to $7 billion a year off-label drug.
Off-label drug.
Off-label. So their whole thing is, because everybody, you know, if this is now the new kind of the new way of doing business, do they use these different pathways to get a drug approved fast, quicker, you know, like whether it's the priority review, the breakthrough therapy designation, but basically where you only have to have one clinical trial, is it really to get the drug on the market? Because as we all know, that once a drug is on the market, a doctor can use it in any way they want to use it. And so really, where this was going to be used is in that whole schizophrenia. And I know that they're also now starting to look at the Alzheimer population. So it was a way to start, you know, testing it and giving it to people. And it's a very expensive drug. But you can give it to people who aren't necessarily the Parkinson's population, which is what the intended approval was for. So, you know, you start looking at all of that, and then you see it's on 199 people. It's not really that great. And then, you know, if you've never been to an advisory committee, you look at who are the people in during the open public comments section of these, where basically for your audience that if they it's basically like an hour maybe that the FDA sets aside for anything that's to give the members of the public an opportunity to address the committee with any comments, like whether they're for the drug, against it. You know, usually each person gets like 3 minutes. But it was very interesting to see who was the audience, who was actually there speaking during the open public comments. It was a lot of the patients or family members all were being paid by, they either participated in the clinical trial, their travel, and everything was paid by the company. And they had some pretty, you know, desperate stories of why they wanted to see this drug approved, right? So that's one thing. And then almost all the other were like the, I call them AstroTurf patient groups, but like the Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Association, the part that basically are supposed to be representing, you know, the disease groups. But they're all, every one of them said they're for this drug. And then when you start and actually dig deeper, you start going, wait, who's giving them their money? And you start, and I always tell people to go and look and see before you, you know, just give money to National Alliance for Mentally Ill, NAMI, which a lot of family members who aren't aware of all the connections will, you know, that's where they'll throw their money after something like a death by suicide. So I always go in and dig deeper and see where all those, who's funding them? Go in and look at their annual reports. Then you see that they're getting their monies from the companies. So of course they're going to be supporting the, you know, the approval and the need for this new drug. So that was another you know, piece of the whole puzzle. And then at the end of the day, it really came down to the risk benefit, and I could not, in good conscience, vote for this drug because I didn't see that the benefit outweighed the risk, the potential, especially for a serious death or you know, the type of adverse event that would require that the drug needed a black box warning put onto it. So I voted no, and of course, being one of two people that voted no, I left pretty discouraged, thinking, why do I keep doing this? It's like I bang my head on a wall. Like, why do I keep doing this? But I do it. But I remember thinking that this will eventually come back to bite us in the, you know, like the committee and the FDA. And there will be families that will be impacted. There will be deaths. And it will eventually end up in the lawyer's hands. And fast forward, when I got the call, you know, maybe a month ago from CNN wanting to, they wanted to talk to me after reading the transcript, and were intrigued by the comments and the questions that I was asking, not only the company, but the FDA, as well as my comments with, after I voted no. But, you know, here we are, and I wish, you know, we would have looked at it, you know, that there would have been more of a serious look at this at the time of approval, because I don't necessarily think that the FDA's job is to automatically approve drugs and put more stuff on the market. You know, I mean, I know that that's what they're there for, but they're also supposed to be representing or, you know, for public health. And because there are, you know, all, I mean, yes, drugs have adverse events, and yes, you know, there's needs for them and whatnot. But at the end of the day, we should not be rushing things to market when, you know, when we haven't really done a full-on test. I mean, it's a small test with the whole goal of getting it approved.
You're doing great work. Don't quit. Please stay in there and come on the radio and do the what you're doing and go on CNN. It's really clear how they're going to go about the off-label marketing, because the FDA is calling it an antipsychotic drug, and it is lumping it with the antipsychotic drugs in general, and calling it even an atypical antipsychotic drug. And they're saying that it is not a dopamine blocker. And that would, of course, make it look very appealing to people. An antipsychotic drug that's not a dopamine blocker. People are going to start telling their patients without any evidence that it won't do this and it won't do that to hurt you. It's a whole new thing. So I think it's just going to be developing this huge market outside of its intended use, and largely because the FDA is willing to call it an atypical antipsychotic drug. And the whole concept of atypical is fraudulent. The atypicals in general produce all the same effects as the old ones, the older drugs, and worse. They produce all kinds of metabolic problems, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. So God knows what we're going to be getting out of this drug eventually in terms of the horror stories. This death rate is just incredible, of 700 deaths already reported. So, I mean, this is just, again, this is the FDA doing more harm than good. I think that one of the major issues is this agency so deep into the swamp of the drug companies and the swamp of the Washington, D.C. lobbyists, that it actually does more harm than good by putting its imprimatur on worthless, damaging drugs. I've researched in the past the effects in general of antipsychotic drugs, including the newer ones, on Parkinsonism, and they worsen Parkinsonism. Very, very much worse than Parkinsonism. I don't know if that came up at all, if people at the committee even had the conversation I'm trying to have right now about this. Were people talking about antipsychotic drugs worsening Parkinsonism at the meetings?
No, there was no discussion. There was discussion of, like, you know, what you just said about, like, the potential of, like, there was one psychiatrist on the committee who I remember him saying that this could actually be a good thing, you know, like another one that's not a dopamine blocker.
Oh, so that's how they're going to push it. Yeah.
And so you could see where, the idea of off-label, that $5 to $7 billion, there really wasn't any mention of could it make, the Parkinson's worsen or the psychosis. And when you, but now looking at the CNN report and in talking with some of those families that literally thought this was going to be an opportunity to like save their loved one and not have their Parkinson's disease get worse. I think they all were under, there were several that were under the impression it would get better, and it actually, the psychosis got worse and they were completely disappointed. And I'm not necessarily sure that they had the harm piece of it or the death piece of it associated with it, but I think what they did have was the disappointment and the promise or the illusion of promise that this was going to be a lifesaver or something that was just going to be, because I think people are desperate. And I think that is where we do a complete disservice, is people want something, right? Or they think they want something, or they're sold something, and then they're disappointed or shocked when something horrific happens, if there's a death, and they find out after the fact that the thing that they thought was supposed to help actually caused the harm. So I think, you know, it's a machine, and I think it's really important that, you know, again, going back to when I left that meeting, I remember thinking, why nobody's asking why, and nobody's even thinking in reporting, because, you know, all of, you know, every, the PR and all the news that was there, whether it was, you know, the Associated Press, the medical journals, they all talked about how it was approval and it was like breakthrough. This is going to be, revolutionary for Parkinson's patients. But I always thought it would be interesting to go, well, who were those two people that voted no? Like, why? I mean, especially because it was the it was the patient rep who lived with a Parkinson's disease and the consumer rep who's representing the public, who ultimately it's the public that pays, who's going to pay the price for these, you know, approvals. Like, nobody asked and wanted to know what they had to say. So I thought,
isn't that bizarre? Isn't that just disgraceful?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not because, you know, I've seen many times, Peter, where, you know, because the people who followed my work, I've seen where they'll say, Witsak, she's always negative. I'm not negative. I'm just asking questions and I'm thinking about things differently because these have real world, real live impacts on people. I mean, these approvals are not just something to like, you know, come to this meeting for an 8-hour day and go along into your research and not realize that. Are they dealing with the people who are hearing from the people who, you know, I always say, because I'm from the Midwest, you know, the middle of America, go to their doctor, get put on a drug, and then find out that something, you know, then they start learning about how the FDA and find out how political it is and find out that the doctors don't even learn about how the FDA works, which I find shocking that if we, the public, have to trust our physicians because it's all built on just faith, right, or trust. And then there's this piece that's missing that if you don't learn how to start, because I think if you learn about how the FDA, and I think every medical student should have to sit through now that we have technology, they should have to attend, watch, you know, whether it's part of their, program, how, like, an FDA advisory committee of something that's controversial. Like right now, just because if you do that, then you can start thinking, huh, well, was this breakthrough therapy? Now I need more information. What does that actually mean? But I think, you know, I'm probably a dreamer thinking that that's going to happen. But, I would love to see that be part of the curriculum because I think it will help with developing critical thinking skills about the drugs they're going to be giving to patients.
Yeah. Oh, God. I'm just looking over now. I've gotten the chance to, as you've been talking, to look over the full prescribing information put out by the FDA. And one of the things, of course, is it not only had such a small group of patients, one clinical trial, the trial was 6 weeks long. So, you know, folks, I mean, think about this. What do you learn about the effectiveness or dangerousness, the safety issues, after 6 weeks on a drug? I mean, practically nothing, unless it's an acute toxin, you know, whose effects are just going to immediately overwhelm the person. You learn very little in 6 weeks. And given the large number of dropouts who probably don't even get tracked during the 6 week period, I mean, you don't have a lot to go on at all. And this is an unusual, skimpy, full prescribing information. Usually there is a guide, a medication guide for the families and patients on new drugs. And there's no medication guide at all on this. Usually there's a pretty extensive information to be shared with the patient right within the thing. And the only thing here is, you know, ask about drug interactions, nothing about the potential dangers of this in the patient counseling information, skimpiest one I've ever seen. And also of interest to me, there's no place in here where it says this drug was approved under special conditions without the usual full testing. There's nothing in there about this to warn physicians about it. I don't see anything here pointing out that it's a rapid approval drug. So that's very interesting too. And it's really, you know, the U.S. government, just about all of its functions now is really out for itself and its cronies, and not out for you folks, not for me or you. And the media isn't. I'm appalled that the media didn't want to talk to the patient representative who has the disorder and to the consumer representative. They're just all of them lapping themselves up to the drug companies, the psychiatric and medical establishment, and on and on and on. We live in an increasingly corrupt age, folks. Oh my God. We're talking with Kim Witzak, and let me spell Kim's last name for you, and please God, let me get it right. W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. W-I-T-C-Z-A-K. I got it right, Kim?
You did. You did.
Oh my God. Well, Kim is an amazing human being. She's been on the show a number of times. You can look her up and listen to some of her earlier shows. This is just a disaster. Now, Kim, you have another drug you wanted to talk about which I know nothing, given the mass hecticness in my life today, I didn't get a chance to even really much talk with you ahead of time and check it out. But let's move on. Do you feel ready to move on to the second
Sure.
drug? We got about 20 minutes to go that you want to talk about. And it's a drug that's extraordinarily relevant to a lot of what's going on now, which is this, the horrific story of acute intoxication with opiates that is killing large numbers of our citizens, including large numbers of young people who've become addicted to these drugs or just even experimenting with these drugs. I know personally of a case of a very wonderful young woman who's struggling with her issues, but wonderful young woman. She wasn't an addict. She partied on opiate drugs and died. Just a tragedy. So what is this new drug that we're talking about today?
Well, this new one, if I'm pronouncing it right, Lucemer, it's lofoxetine. But anyways, it's a non-opioid to treat opioid withdrawal symptoms. So it's basically, and you know, we do need things. I mean, obviously the opioid crisis is, it's obviously it's on in every the news all the time. It's on, you know, it's part of Washington's agenda. It has real world consequences, as you just mentioned, somebody, whether it's experimenting with it, whether it was really given to people under the right conditions for pain, and then, you know, then it gets abused, and regardless, trying to get off of it. And there's been, so I wanted to like this drug, right? I wanted to like anything that can help, especially, you know, the symptoms of opioid. It's abrupt opioid withdrawal. But so let me give you just a little bit of background on this drug. There were two questions that the FDA basically wanted to, or that the company was trying to get two indications approved. The one indication was that it mitigated symptoms associated with abrupt opioid withdrawal. So basically, if you know you are quitting cold turkey, it will help to mitigate some of the symptoms, you know, the serious symptoms that people have with abruptly withdrawing. So that was one indication. And then the other one the company was trying to get was something called facilitation with the completion of opioid discontinuation treatment. Now, when I hear all of that, I mean, that's a big mouthful, but really that's about, like, when you hear the word facilitation with completion, it makes it seem like it'll cure you of it, right? It'll help you get off of it. And that's really not what it was. So the FDA, instead of looking at the two indications separately, they actually put it into one, they wrapped it all up into one bow, into one kind of question was, should it be approved? And basically, I remember, like, we, you know, the committee actually had a lot of dialogue around it. It was actually a pretty engaged committee.
Has it been approved?
The advisory committee voted 11-1 to vote to approve it. Now it's just waiting for the FDA's approval. So,
okay, spell the name of it for me. And I apologize to my great audience for not having prep time today. It's probably the first time with Kim, simply because a bunch of things were going on in my office and just lots of activities, important and good ones. But spell the name of the drug for me. So you're here sort of learning with me, folks, today. What is the name? Spell it.
LUCEMYRA. And it's from a company, U.S. World Meds.
Okay, I got it. FDA advisory committee votes in favor of, I don't know how to pronounce it either at this point, but Lucemira.
Yep.
And the official chemical is Lofexidine, L-O-F-E-X-I-D-I-N-E. So, patients experienced less severe withdrawal symptoms and were more likely to complete a 7-day opioid discontinuation treatment. And it's going to be a blockbuster because it's going to be advertised as the first and only non-opioid medication for withdrawal symptoms.
Yep, you got it.
So here are these clever things that that happened. So the committee voted 11-1, and you were the one who did not recommend?
Yes, I was the one.
Well, listen, folks, I want out there to cheer for Kim Witzak. If you Google this drug, and the reason I was having trouble locating it, because it hasn't been approved yet, LOFEXIDINE for the mitigation of opioid withdrawal symptoms, you'll see, as Kim has said, that it was approved by 11-1, and one is on our radio show. God bless you, Kim. I'm proud. It's a proud moment for me to have the one on my radio show.
I think you're about the only one. No, actually, I will say there was one. It was a biotech media that actually reported on it. It's because, so let me tell you why, the data first of all, you know, with the questions that we got asked after we listened to it and we heard, you know, we heard the stories of the people who have, you know, what it's like for opioid withdrawal and, you know, all of that. But the question, it was interesting. You got to watch the way that these questions get worded. So the one question was like, it will help with opioid withdrawal symptoms or withdrawal. Well, no, actually, it's abrupt opioid withdrawal. So I asked the FDA, could you please add the word abrupt before opioid withdrawal? Because there were several people from the members of the public that came and spoke who talked about how they had to slowly wean themselves off of opioids, and it took, you know, several weeks. This drug was not about that. This drug was for abrupt, so meaning you're just quitting cold turkey. So, like, that's a very different type of withdrawal. So I could see it getting, if it wasn't, you know, with that word abrupt, like, so that was one, so that indication or whatnot, I actually saw the data. I was fine with it because I think it did for the abrupt. It was enough. There wasn't anything that was really concerning, but it was more on the longer term, the facilitation of completion. Now, I asked if that question could actually, when they came back down to the final question of should it be approved, I said, could we separate the two indications? And the FDA said, no, just, you know, and I wasn't the only one. Other people asked for it too. But at the end of the day, when they went around, and the woman who runs the department at the FDA said, no, we want to keep it in here, but when you go around and qualify your vote and explain why you voted a certain way, you can say why you did or didn't vote for it. Well, here's what's interesting. Everybody voted, so they voted yes for it. But when they actually, I'd say a good handful of them, if you actually went and they went around and you listened to why they voted a certain way, they actually said, well, I was fine with the, you know, the abrupt completion, but or the abrupt withdrawal symptoms, but not the total completion. Well, then I'm like, why did you vote yes? Because now that is an 11-to-1 vote, right? Where I said, because you asked it in this kind of general, give them one big blanket approval, I have to vote no, because I'm afraid that when you use those words, completion of facilitation of completion, I said, I know marketing, it will get completely blown out of, and people will think that it's going to help with the total, you know, basically quitting and getting off of opioids, which is not what this drug did. So, and it also had issues with cardiac, you know, there's definitely some cardiac related issues. And you got to remember with clinical trials, they're all designed with no other real world other scenarios. So they're in a facility, so they're being watched, right? But then they're not on any other drugs. So they're not on antidepressants. They're not on all these other things, which you know a lot of people are on, going to be on other prescription drugs as well. But that's not how they get tested, because if you got tested in the real world, I mean, the real world market and scenarios don't happen in clinical trials, because you want to have the best, you know, foot forward to show that your drug works. So there were all sorts of things, and it was just the idea of how that was an example of how political it is, and not wanting to actually, you know, so people voted yes, but then in their qualified answers, they said, well, I probably wouldn't have voted. I shouldn't have really wanted to vote for the second indication, but that's not how it was worded. So now history will show you that it was approved, right? And one of my other comments, and this is what I feel really passionate about, because I go back to the antidepressants, and I know you've been around when you probably were there back in the 91 hearings, when it was during the AIDS crisis. And there was a lot of public pressure put on the FDA to, you know, they're not approving drugs fast enough to deal with the AIDS crisis. And that happened at the same time as the antidepressant products that were coming on the market. And I believe that that same type of public pressure of like, we got to do more for opioids. We need more. You know, putting that pressure on the FDA is going to have a backlash, and it's potentially a backlash like it did with the antidepressants and how they quickly approve things, not being as demanding as they ought to be for, you know, establishing efficacy back in the day with antidepressants. But it was all during the AIDS because of the pressure that the public was putting on the FDA for AIDS and the drugs for and approving things. So that was another big concern of mine on this one, is there's so much public pressure and the narrative of, we need to approve things faster. We need more. But maybe we need to slow down and really make sure that we're doing the right thing first.
Well, that sounds very, very reasonable. And the drug is not going to relieve any of the craving. It's just going to maybe soften withdrawal symptoms. And how did they even study abrupt withdrawal symptoms? I mean, did they literally abruptly withdraw people and give them this drug?
Yep, that's exactly how they did. It was a small number of people on this, but apparently this drug has been on the market in Europe.
So it's been around in Great Britain for a little while.
Yeah, I was fascinated. One of the questions that I had asked the FDA is, that I said would have been interesting to have somebody from the UK to come and talk about their experience with this drug since it's been on the market. But, you know, of course, we don't like to do that. And I always think that part of an FDA approval process should really involve all kinds of information, right? Looking at, again, going back to like the antidepressants or even like the recent the Chantix where the FDA removed the black box warning. I think that we need to have all sets of data and all sets of not just what the company supplies and the FDA. Like if there's other information from other researchers or other countries, then I think that should be a part of the process too, that we're putting the right drugs or making sure that we're analyzing something from a 360-degree perspective.
Yeah. Kim, say a few words and catch us up, and because people don't really know about much about this. The Chantix, which is a smoking drug, it's a drug to relieve the withdrawal symptoms from cigarettes, from nicotine. And in Tom Moore's excellent study of FDA reports and factoring in the number of prescriptions that people got, Chantix was at the top of being associated with serious violence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And apparently the FDA, once you pick it up from there, what did the warning say and tell us more about how one of the rare occasions a black box warning was removed when it dealt in part with a study showing that it was justified in having a more severe warning. But go ahead, pick up on that story, would you?
So I find this one also fascinating because I was supposed to be a member, the consumer representative on this committee, where we're actually looking at the removal of the black box warning. So basically the black box warning was the most serious of adverse events where it talked about psychosis, violence, hallucinations, et cetera. Well, it's the first time the FDA has actually removed a black box warning. But it's interesting, if you actually go back and look at the history of it, there were massive lawsuits. There was over like 3,800 lawsuits against Pfizer for basically the violence, psychosis, all of that. Well, Pfizer settled every one of those cases, basically silenced all the victims and their lawyers. So then that's when they came to the FDA and said, we've been doing studies over in Europe to do with this, the adverse events that were what the black box warning, you know, because obviously black box warning, it has, it impacts how you can advertise a drug, how you can, what kind of materials are given to a patient at the doctor's. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't necessarily want, from a business standpoint, a black box warning. So basically, they came to the FDA and said, we've done new studies. It warrants the removal of this black box warning because, you know, smoking is a huge public health crisis, et cetera. Well, sure enough, at that hearing, which, again, I got removed literally 3 days before the FDA advisory committee, I was told that I had an intellectual bias and that it was brought to their attention by Pfizer. So I got kicked off the committee. I couldn't be there, but I still showed up to make sure that I was representing the voice because I knew that they were, that I had talked to many of the victims who could never, they literally had websites talking about their experiences. They had to take all of that down. And so basically Pfizer got to present it, all their data. They got to have many people from, you know, smoking, anti-smoking organizations talk about get rid of the black box warning because we need, people are afraid to take this drug. Fast forward, the FDA removes the black box warning in an unprecedented move. They got to have Chantix, I think it was another year. It just went generic, I think in beginning of April. So the public has no idea, like now, let's say they go to try to quit now. They didn't know that it actually has this. It used to have a black box warning.
Right, right. And people were made to take down their websites?
Yes, that was part of the legal in the litigation.
Oh, so somebody the people like who were suing had to take down their websites.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
But have we gotten to the point where other people had to also take down their websites?
I don't know about that. It was anybody who had a lawsuit as part of the settlement. They had to, they had something like My Work, Woody Matters, I would have had to take my website down. And I could no longer, and they could also never publicly tell their story again.
Wow. All right, folks, this is America. We've been talking with Kim Witczak, WITCZAK. You can find her on the website, learn more about her. She's a hero. She really stands up for us and for the country and for good in the world. And thanks for being on the show again. And you will be on again and again. Thank you, Kim.
Thanks. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.